latest episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast hosted by data protection people. My name is Ollie Ritt and I'm joined for the purposes of this intro, as per usual, by Miles Dacres, but also, in a turn of events, by Phil Brining. Hello, chaps.
Hello, Ollie. Hello, Miles.
Hello, Bob.
Have you done one of these before, Phil, one of these little intros?
I've done one before, yes.
You've done one. Okay. Good. Well, hopefully that gives you some experience. It was a good session today, wasn't it? I mean, we were just joking off air that we almost lost it at one point. but otherwise, it was a lot of fun, I thought.
I have to say, I really enjoyed it. I haven't done one for quite a few weeks. Just things keep cropping up on a Friday that stopped me joining. But I really enjoyed it, actually, because we had quite a lot of participation from the participants, those other people other than us on the show, if you like. And you know, what was good was that we had quite a lot of interaction on the news stuff, but we talked a lot about the privacy tech scene, didn't we? And you know, for instance, the use of Excel for ROPAs and OneTrust and DP Organizer and various other tools and the Canils PAA tool. And it was really good to get that kind of input from people saying, you know, I've used this and I think it's really good, and I've used that, and you know, it's got gaps in it, and I think the conclusion is that people would like us to try and do some more structured research around what products are available in the market, and then, you know, give some kind of pros, cons, and an evaluation if we can do that. I think it's quite a lot of work to do it properly, but you know, that was a really good, I thought it was a great conversation, to be honest.
Yes, and Miles, I think we'll probably try and get that set up, won't we? I mean, we're maybe not in the immediate future, but that's certainly something that we can look to build around, can't we?
Definitely. Yeah. I think it's potentially even worth us putting together a piece of writing. I know that when I'm looking to use a new piece of software, I often type in what's the best system, and you'll often find pages on Google that'll have the top five, I don't know, the top five dating websites, for example. It might give you the pros and cons of every dating website.
You went to that a bit quickly.
I was scrambling there for a different example.
Yeah, it's not as easy as it looked, is it?
Yeah, so if you, and often it'll give you sort of an insight into how many users it has, what people's reviews are, what the star rating is, and so on and so forth. So I mean, we could quite easily put something like that together and then follow up with a discussion as well. So yeah, if you are a listener, then definitely keep your eyes peeled for that. And we will put something together in the near future, I'm sure.
And where can they find out more information about all upcoming sessions, Miles?
If you do need to find out anything, any information about key speakers, and you can even search our events based on a sector, based on whatever sector you're in. So if you are looking for events in the education sector or in housing or whatever sector you might be in, you can actually tailor that search to that as well. So if you visit our website, it's www.dataprotectionpeople.com/events. You'll find the full lineup and all the details on there. If you scroll down to the bottom of any of the events, you'll find a sign up form. You can pop your email address in there and we'll add you to our subscribers list, which is now at 850 subscribers. So quite a community of data protection practitioners there.
Absolutely fabulous. And it's always better when people get involved like they did today, isn't it, Phil?
It is, absolutely. Yeah, it is because it's not just about us yakking on. It's great to get other people's. It's essential to get other people's perspectives. It makes you think, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's a collaborative it's space.
Yeah.
It's really good. And so we're not going to keep going on. We'll let you get into the main body of the podcast. But
we'll be another 35 minutes over if we're not getting.
Yeah, exactly. But good session today. Really fun. We talked a little bit about what was in the news. Be warned, some sort of darker subject matter in there, obviously, with things that are going on at the minute around the world. But still, broadly, also some very light-hearted and very interesting points about privacy more generally. So, without further ado,
course, Dave's Holmes' great joke.
Yes, that's very true. Actually, Dave. Dave's not here this week, so he sent me with a joke in his stead. So you'll have to stay tuned in to hear Dave's joke for the week. He also sent me with a rant to deliver, which I think
I did justice
to. Yeah. There was one other thing actually I was going to say. I'm going to keep doing it every week until eventually we get there. But if you are listening on a streaming platform, if you could give us a rating, it would be massively appreciated. It really helps us get the name out there. It helps us improve the podcast just generally, because more people come in, more opportunities to share knowledge, build a community, everyone benefits. So if you drop us a rating, any feedback at all, if you want to get in touch with us, how we can improve things, how we can be better, we're always looking for that. So that's enough from us. Without further ado, we will let you get stuck into this latest episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast. I've done enough rambling. Phil, let's get stuck in. We like to do a bit of news, don't we? So what have you seen in the news? I've got some bits you don't seem to have added to my notes document, so I'm hoping...
I was going to surprise you.
Go on then.
I saw it. This is interesting. Well, it's not that interesting, actually, but I was amused to see that the re-election campaigns of all the French presidential candidates, none of them comply with the GDPR. So that was quite interesting. And the worst in terms of compliance was that actually Emmanuel Macron's. So that was something I saw. Also interesting, again, you might have some...
So hang on. Sorry, before you bounce on from that, in what way were they not compliant?
Oh, there's a whole range of reasons why, but it varies from website to website. But, you know, insufficient privacy information, no information about the international transfers for use of MailChimp and Facebook Pixel and Google Analytics and non-compliant on cookies. The story says that one candidate who's a staunch nationalist is using American services and he should be using French services. So it's quite an interesting article.
That is quite funny. sorry, you were about to say something else and I cut across you there.
Yeah, I was going to say that the CNIL have launched their strategic plan or relaunched their strategic plan. No, I actually think it is launched. It's 22-24. And again, I was interested in the themes that are coming out there. That there's three themes, and the second theme is kind of trying to promote the GDPR as a trusted framework for data controllers. I know we're talking about France and Europe, but again, some of the regulators have introduced their strategic plans, haven't they? And so what the CNIL are saying is they want to develop certification and code of conduct tools and schemes and some other bits and pieces as well. So that was quite interesting to have a quick skim through what they're doing. And because we're working on the housing code of conduct, and I was actually writing some stuff up for a customer yesterday about international transfers, and one of the international transfers or two of the international transfers is reliant on a code of conduct or a certification scheme. And of course there aren't any yet. So I was interested in that because we need those things bringing through, don't we? We need those codes of conduct and certification schemes putting together and publishing either generically or for specific industries. So I saw that as well, which again was quite interesting to read from one point of view. I also saw, again, you probably seen this and commented on it earlier, that there's been comments around the international data sharing for security and anti-terrorism purposes, and that there's some of the EU officials are kind of pushing back on the US and saying, it's going to be difficult to get this data sharing agreement in place with the US, and the accountability. The Information Accountability Foundation is saying, hang on a minute, we need to be accelerating this type of stuff. Otherwise, it can't, we've got to be in the same arena when we're looking at international terrorism. And a lot of this is relating to the war in Ukraine.
Sure.
And I noticed also that Ukraine Ministry of Defense has been given access to Clearview AI's facial recognition technology. And you probably saw that, so that they can try and identify using social media and then the information they're collecting from the Russian troops, trying to correlate all that together. Again, that's really, really interesting that's happening. It's happening in a war zone, and massive implications on AI and facial recognition in all sorts of walks of life. So I was really interested in seeing that as well. So sorry, that's a bit of a whistle stop tour of
no, that's that quite caught my that's attention. Quite all right. That's quite all right. That's very interesting. Doesn't that? Maybe I'm making things up now, but doesn't that time with the fact that the police have just gotten clearance for their use of facial recognition after the trial that they ran recently. Or am I making that up? Someone correct me on that.
I haven't seen that.
I feel like that went through relatively recently, or at least there was a development in relation to it, shall we say. Anyway, let's talk about things that I have got more information about. Slightly less glamorous, but I thought it was still interesting to raise because I've seen some commentary around it. Was, I don't know if you saw this, Phil, was the audit of the Home Office by the ICO.
And, no, I didn't. I was really interested in your point on it, though, and I do want to go and have a look at it.
Yeah, so I've got a link here if anyone wants it. Actually, there's so it's not a full report, FYI, but there's sort of a 12-page summary, shall we say, I'm just getting a bit of feedback. There's a 12-page summary of their findings, effectively. I'm just trying to put it in the chat now. Regular listeners will know that we're not brilliant at multitasking. But one of the things that comes out of that, and I think this is what I've seen a lot of commentary on, colleagues and peers talking about, is the fact that one of the findings from the ICO in relation to the Home Office is they sort of say, oh, it's fantastic. The Home Office have implemented 30% of controls to meet compliance standards. And you sort of read that and go, right, well, what about the 70% that are left? Because that's a really weird way.
It's a relatively small number, isn't it?
It's 30%. Well done. Well, you 70%. I'm being slightly unfair. It's actually, I think, a 31-69% split. But
yeah, you're rounding down, are you? I'm rounding down.
Yeah, I'm not being fair to them. But it just comes off as I hate to say it because regular listeners know we spend far too much time bashing the ICO, quite frankly, but. Again, this doesn't help their case, I don't think, because it comes off as, well, you seem to be letting them off pretty lightly here. They gave them it's almost like a glowing write-up of the Home Office, but really, anyone reading between the lines can see that they're not in a good state at all, and there are controls or elements of compliance that they're not currently deemed to be compliant with. That are basics, things around the fact that privacy notices aren't right, the fact that they're not getting valid consent. Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but those to me are not difficult things.
I would have thought fairly fundamental.
Exactly.
So Home Office, did you say?
Yes, it is. I popped a link in if anyone wants to go and have a look. the other thing being that, again, they sort of gloss over the fact that in relation to the actions to bring them into compliance, they found a bunch of them were in urgent need of implementation. Which is quite strong to say that you urgently need to make changes. And yet again, this was presented as something that didn't seem, at least in language, to be too big of an issue. I don't know. Maybe I'm extrapolating.
I encourage people to
go and have a look.
I absolutely agree with that because I'm looking at page 8 now and it's an area for improvement. The Home Office record of process activity are not sufficiently detailed to be fully compliant with the requirements of Article 30. Isn't that a major issue? And this is interesting. Yeah. Data mapping being carried out is not yet complete. So they're raising that as an issue. You know, well, is it a requirement to do data mapping? The Home Office Information Asset Register doesn't contain all the necessary information. You know, and they're saying, you know, under Article 5, 1F and 24, you know, they're expecting to see an Information Asset Register. Maybe that's biggest to the public authority. Mm. The Office of the DPO doesn't have sufficient resources. Again, fairly fundamental. The security policy framework has been historically fragmented and is currently undergoing a comprehensive review. I mean, I'm surprised that they haven't given them a bit more of a roasting, to be honest.
Well, I've got more on that, actually. And Emma's just popped a link in the chat. And Emma, I was about to come to that particular piece of news, so thank you for sharing it. In fact, it's not a piece of news which I found. Let me be clear on this. This is Dave Holmes' rant for the week. I'm simply relaying it on his behalf. But I don't know if everyone else saw this, but basically there's some enforcement action from the ICO, I think this week or last week, relatively recently anyway. Directed at, I believe, they're either a law firm or they're generally legal advisory type. I won't name them. Just you can find the link in the chat. You can go and have a look. But basically, the enforcement action relates to the fact that they had these two subject access requests in and didn't deal with them for like 2 years, which is, you know, a long time. They were consistently chased about them. Oh, sorry, I'm getting a bit of feedback.
Did he say about pruning
the
plants today?
Sorry about that. I was just dealing with a bit of feedback.
Yeah.
They didn't deal with these two D cells for 2 years, and they were consistently chased by the data subject and by the ICO. And after all of that, basically the ICO have come out and said, oh, please, could you sort it out? It'd be awfully good of you if you could just, you know, respond. No, come on, get on them, you know.
It's unbelievable, isn't it?
Come on, like, do something. You know, this is, and I have to say, I'm not having to relay Dave's rant here, because I'm also quite annoyed about this. Exactly, Angela, sharing a Hulk gif. you know, sort it out. It's not good enough. And the message it sends is completely wrong. You can't just ignore subject access requests for 2 years. You know, you've got to deal with them. It's a fundamental part of the legislation, and you're not complying with it. Mm. It's literally all about rights, and you're not complying with them. And it's not good enough if the regulator's basically just saying, oh, go on, sort it out. Come on.
Please sort it out, yeah.
Please. You know, get involved. Use your powers a bit. Anyway, that's me done. Anyone care to pile on?
There's a few chat comments into the port, and you know, it's quite right. It's privileged practitioners. We're trying to get the message home, you know, to everybody in our organisations, including management. And my view is that approach totally undermines our efforts.
Yeah, and I the thing that's most frustrating, right, is actually we had some conversations. So on our last episode where we spoke about fundraising in the hospice sector, right, we had some really good conversations with some of the people on that about the fact that the ICO can be really helpful and supportive. And you shouldn't always be afraid of the ICO, because they're not there to punish you. But the problem is sometimes they do need to punish you, right? And this is where the message is all wrong. It's fine to not, you know, not tear everything up and come charging in if an organisation is making genuine efforts and they've just gotten something wrong. But where an organisation has consistently disregarded, as you said, Phil, a cornerstone of the legislation for a couple of years, that's not good enough. They should get a kicking. Yeah, absolutely. Anyway, that's my piece done. Rick makes a very good – there's plenty going on in the chat, so if anyone's not got that open, I encourage them to go and take a look. But Rick makes a very good point, which is annoying, considering that they strut about with PECA fines consistently. And you sort of think, come on, can we have some GDPR fines, please? Anyway, Phil, I'm gonna relinquish.
No, Michael's put in an interesting, again, a good link to a ransomware attack. Again, I've seen a couple, I think, ransomware attacks where the ICO said you just simply didn't have sufficient technical and organisational measures in place to prevent or protect against a ransomware attack. So they found this law firm. I've only just found this, so thank you very much, Michael, for putting it in. £198,000. So, you know, do you remember we had a client, a charity client, 3 years ago? They got ransomware, or rather their IT platform provider, providing their Microsoft Office platform, got ransomware. And all their systems were offline for 6 weeks. Couldn't do anything, couldn't pay anybody, couldn't take any money. Do you remember that, Ollie?
Yes, I do, vaguely.
Yeah.
Yes.
Ransomware attack. And I think at the time the ICO said that they didn't think it was a reportable breach. Do you remember we had all that hoo-ha with the ICO about, you know, is there been a breach of security? Remember, we used to ring them up, didn't we? They used to say, oh, no, that's not a breach of security. Well, what's your name? You know, let's write this down.
Mm.
Do you remember that? Remember we were in the old office and we had all these... I mean, they seem to have got their thoughts in line now, but... interesting, you know, you get a cyber attack, ransomware attack, and, you know, they say, well, you haven't got enough measures in place, like multi-factor authentication, patching. I'm doing a project with a customer at the moment, and, I mean, they are really exposed. They know they're really exposed. They've got no patching. They haven't been patching for years. They've got old, like 20-year-old infrastructure.
Wow.
You know, it's coaxial Ethernet cables for the techies. You know, it's what? It's, I haven't seen that since the 90s. That's what they've got. And, you know, it's really creaking. And they've got, you know, key servers, the domain controller is multitasking. It's being used as a file server. And they're really exposed to all sorts of problems. And, you know, they know about it and they're dealing with it. But, you know, it's like winging a prayer that they aren't getting attacked each day, really.
She probably should spend more on equipment and golf days, really, like solicitors. I think the one for me on this was it was kind of multifaceted, because actually it wasn't the main systems, it was their archive. So there was a shared password for a remote desktop. There was like one remote desktop shared password. The store itself had no encryption, had no patch management, there was no MFA. And they hadn't defined the retention period. That's really what's got them into, they're archiving all this data kind of willy-nilly as well. So it wasn't just the technical, it's actually the sheer bulk of data they got on there as well, which was, they weren't particularly happy with. But yeah, I think this is, it's also the first GDPR fine under the new commissioner as well, which is why it caught my eye. It's a really interesting one, not just from the technical side of things. It was actually what they were trying to protect as well, which I found kind of interesting, because obviously they're not doing records management either.
Yeah. And back to Angela's point about, you know, the home office, you know, the impact that a data breach could have, you know, on citizens and it's the same with solicitors, isn't it? The sort of information that's likely to be in that archive
is exactly. Stuff. And we even saw it with the Home Office, didn't we? In the there was a MOPI, misuse of private information claim, that was successful a couple years ago. That's one of the key pieces of common law. In that area is the Home Office was sued by it was a bunch of people. I think they might have been people who had refugee status previously.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
It's called TLT and others versus the Home Office. Basically the Home Office posted their details across the internet when they shouldn't have done, and all those poor people who just settled were forced to move. It's one of the biggest payouts under this type of misuse of private information claim. I could be wrong, but absolutely spot on with that point. You know, it's important you get this right, because the impact is potentially really substantial.
So that was Dave's rant, was it?
It was, broadly speaking, yes. So I hope I did him justice. I think I did. I sense myself getting a bit caught up in that. There's a couple other points which are worth pointing out this week. We spoke about PECA fines a minute ago. I don't know if specifically the ones that Rick was referring to, but these ones, there's like five companies that have been fined, I think total just under $500,000. The thing that's frustrating about this, right, is it's not just nuisance. So apparently they were specifically targeting vulnerable older people, people potentially with memory problems, people who can't manage their affairs quite so well, and basically selling redundant insurance policies to them that they didn't need for sort of white goods and things like that. And the ICO, you know, found evidence, or at least in the write-up I read, the ICO found evidence that they were doing this, you know, deliberately and sharing these marketing lists of vulnerable people. And when I said under $500,000, that's under $500,000 cumulatively for five organisations, when obviously they could have been fined $500,000 each in theory.
I think it wasn't the lowest fine, $15,000.
Something like that. I think it was even lower. I think it was about four. The lowest.
I mean, it's nuts, isn't it? I've recounted that my rant about sitting next to a guy who ran a data broking business. Friend's wedding, and he was just kind of laughing, saying, "Well, the ICO might find us, you know, but we just wind the company down and spin up a new one, we just carry on again, and by the time they've caught us up, we'll do the same again." I mean, these people need stopping in their tracks.
Well, director's liability, you're always talking about it.
Yeah, but it's not seeing the evidence of it being used.
Yeah, exactly. But anyway, I just thought it was worth raising that. I mean, it's a really, really awful thing to do, and it's just a shame that they've not been
properly fined.
Exactly. Mm. Yeah. And on that note, actually, just a last piece of news, and unless you've obviously got anything else, Phil, or unless the listeners have got anything, but I saw today, I was doing the rounds trying to find things to talk about, quite frankly, preparation for this session. But I saw Facebook have now been fined in Ireland by the Irish regulator. And I don't have too much to say about this, in all honesty, because I've not looked into it much. It's in relation to some data breach and the fact they didn't have appropriate technical organisational measures in place. But the number I found surprising, they've been fined €17 million. I wonder how you come to that figure. It's just, like, maybe the rationale is set out somewhere, but it just seemed like a weird figure to pick, because you're clearly not going off of any of the percentage options available to them, because Facebook are massive, so you'd have thought it would have been a lot higher had that been the case.
Mm.
And you're not using the maximum ceiling of your fine regime. Weird figure to arrive at. If anyone's got any clarification, let me know. But I just thought that was a bit odd, stood out to me. Completely agree, Emma. You'd have thought that it'd be a massive aggravating factor in the fines.
Yeah.
Very much agree. Phil, any other news items that you wanted to discuss?
Not really. No, and I heard on the radio as I was driving around this week about the online harms. Is it a bill or has it been enacted now? I can't remember.
I think it's still a bill technically.
Yeah.
Maybe.
but that again, I think that's related obliquely to what we do. So that's worth having a look at some point, you know, when that progresses.
Yes, there's a lot of movement on that. The latest thing that I read was that they're now incorporating, I think the politically correct term for it is cyber flashing as a criminal offence now under that bill.
Is that an LED going on and off like that?
I wish it were.
All right, okay.
But yeah, let you all make inferences about what cyber flashing might involve. But set to be criminalised under this bill, which is interesting. And there's a lot about this at the minute, because this is slightly tangential to what we do, but it is possibly worth raising. I was doing some reading about this case where Facebook have been dragging their heels on providing information in relation to, unfortunately, and I do apologise for bringing this up, but a young lady who sadly took her own life, and basically as a result, more or less directly, of some of the content that she was exposed to at far too younger age. And it all sort of ties in, and that you can't help but have this sort of, bad taste really in the mouth when you read about a fine of $17 million, which really isn't a lot for breaches. And yes, I know it's not related, but at the same time, the same company's dragging their heels in this case. And it's all against the backdrop of this online safety bill and trying to improve things, and really not getting any support or buy-in from these large social media organisations. It's quite troubling, really, and it's quite frustrating, I think, possibly. But it is definitely worth keeping an eye on, as you say, Phil. Anyway, that was particularly dark, so I do apologise. Let's try and shift on to something
Michael's story is funny. I think I did hear this. NVIDIA had a data breach, a hacking breach, and there's a whole load of passwords that are on this thing, you know, like, guess what the passwords are? NVIDIA is the password. Password is the password. Welcome is a password. QWERTY is a password. It's quite funny, actually, that.
Ready to work. That's quite good. And someone less creatively has just put in September. That's interesting.
Yes.
Well, the guidance on passwords, correct me if I'm wrong, but the current guidance seems to be 3 random words, right, and a couple of special characters. That, as far as I'm aware, is the way to calibrate your passwords, or have I just made that up?
No, I don't know. There's probably people on here that have got much better view than us. But, I mean, we always refer back to, you know, the PCIDSS. It has to be 8 characters and changed every, 30 days, I think, for the, you know, for the PCI. I mean, they're changing, obviously, the PCIDSS this year, but that's kind of hard coded into it. I mean, my favorite for my password locker, I've got the lyric of a song which must be 15-20 words long.
I mean, it's not a bad way to do it. Rick's right, it's absurd. There's a four character password in there, which is NVIDIA but not even spelt properly. I mean, that's absurd. People confirming that is from the National Cybercrime Agency, the NCSC guidance, that 3 random word thing. I use that, but
it does make things quite difficult to remember. I have to sometimes keep them in a little notebook with hints.
Which three words do you have? Oliver Horatio Rea. I mean,
A, that's not my middle name. and B, no, I'm not using my own name for it. Or maybe I am. Who knows?
Who knows, indeed, right.
Don't be guessing my passwords. I'm not giving any more hints. Moving swiftly on. Well, I tell you what, let's No, that segue.
I think people start using their you know, the three words location. That'll be what people will use.
What do you mean?
Office, you know, the three little words where it locates a meter. Is it a meter square or 3 meters square on Earth?
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah.
So you pick your desk and you have your three little words.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I do.
Your favourite pub. You know.
Yeah, do generally just look up and see what's in the room and use them, but shush, don't tell anyone that. So one of the things we wanted to talk about today, I was trying to come up with a segue and it just won't work, I'm afraid. But you wanted to talk, Phil, and you were talking about when I arrived, which
Matthew
records
says he uses
management platforms.
Yeah, Matthew says he uses a random word generator, but how do you remember then? I mean, each time you use it, it'll give you a different... I mean, unfortunately, people fall into I should imagine the same trap of using the same three words because that's what they remember. So once again, you get it's hacked in on the dark web, then it's not an easy thing, is it? The password thing. Because the more you have, you know, the more variations, you log on to something, it says, oh, no, you got to have 10. So, I'll change my standard password and add a few extra characters on. Then the next one, it says, oh, it's got to have a character in it as well as a number and a letter. All right, okay, well, you end up just... You just lose track of it, don't you? You have to have some sort of password vault. Really.
Yeah. I mean, my partner has a physical notebook where she doesn't keep the full passwords, but she'll keep a couple of letters and a hint, which is far more organised than I could ever be. But
300 pages long.
Yeah.
Alphabetically indexed.
It's one way
to becomes
do
a
it.
Structured filing system, doesn't it? If it's that straight. Anyway, moving on.
Oh, don't start. Well, come on, you wanted to talk about records management software or platforms.
I wanted to gauge people's view that are kind of participating in this. So I've just picked up a piece of work which started on Monday or Tuesday this week, which is requiring me to use a customer's OneTrust platform. So the first job I've got to do is what OneTrust calls data mapping, which is effectively compiling records of processing activities. So I've got to go out to the business and I've got to interview all these different people and build these records of processing activities. Anyway, what it has done is it's given me exposure, you know, quite detailed exposure to OneTrust. And, you know, most of the time I'm doing another project for a customer loading data from their records of processing activity, which is Excel based, you know, one sheet per department. And I'm loading that into our equivalent of OneTrust data-wise. And then we're aware of like DP organized. So I just thought it'd be interesting to have a conversation about who uses what and if people have used OneTrust or got a view in it. I mean, there's some really neat things in it, you know, the way it publishes the cookies out into the privacy notice and stuff like that. You know, some good stuff. But I just wondered if it's worth having a discussion about, you know, privacy tech, as it's called, and what platforms people are using for various you know, record keeping and workflow.
I know you're
using OneTrust as well, aren't you, for a different project?
Yes, also using OneTrust at the minute. I've also used DP Organizer. I've when you've allowed me to, occasionally played with our own platform. I mean, I think one thing we have to say from the outset, right, is that there's not necessarily any right or wrong way to do any of this. And I don't think, well, people are free to correct me on this, but I don't think necessarily that any of the kit is better or worse. It's just a case of pros and cons and what works best for you, right? I don't know, maybe I'm being a bit too naive.
I think probably how much control you need, whether you need a proper multi-user system, you know, whether how big it is, therefore do you need audit trails? So it's all right using Excel, but all the stuff that a database does, but when we've been over this loads of times, haven't we? All the stuff a database does, you don't get proper multi-user. You don't get audit trails. You don't get metadata around people who've updated or made changes. You don't get any workflow reminding you to check things. So Excel's fine, you know, and we talked about this yesterday, didn't we? It's free. Well, it's not free, but, you know, people have got it as part of their Office package. So effectively, it's kind of free. It's flexible. But with that comes the downside. You know, people add in columns, move things around. You know, they get with the database, you've got the value option of using pick lists and multi-select pick lists and checkboxes and different things. And, you know, you can do that within Excel, of course, with data validation. But if people are typing in text and they're getting it wrong, misspelling it, or using the different, slightly different terminology to represent the same thing, then it's really hard to manage, you know, at a high level, all those records. It's all right when you get it into an individual row in Excel, but when you say, well, how many of these records are from this department, you find that the department's spelt differently or wrongly, or which are using, you know, this particular lawful grounds, and you find that, you know, people are putting like three entries because it's just a text thing, you know, because they haven't actually put in data validation. It then starts to become, I think, you know, counterproductive to have your OPAs if you're expecting other people to maintain them. But it's just harder, I think, on Excel. But OneTrust, I believe, is very, very expensive.
Yeah, so that's the thing, right? Because arguably, we were talking about this yesterday or the day before. We were saying that the thing with Excel is arguably it's got scalability, but that's not necessarily a good thing, right? I mean, in theory, you can generate bumper records with it, but there's also going to be a downside to that. I mean, and you're right, ultimately it depends, I guess, how confident you are with Excel. And if you're a whiz at Excel, then you can probably extract far more value, shall we say, from it than a lot of people otherwise could. I know one thing that drives you mad is merge cells, for instance. Because
it's hard to do anything with them, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. And that's the thing. And I think ultimately, I mean, not sort of, you know, hack down the conversation where it is, but to my mind, the main thing is really all of this kit is only really as good as the person who's designing whatever it is you're doing in there, whether it's records, whether it's, you know, because some of them integrate like DPIA assessments, for instance. You know, how well designed is that? Well, you know, that's the person who's designed it. The kit itself will do wonderful things, but if there's, you know, problems in your process or your questions aren't worded right, or as you mentioned, you know, you allow free text, for instance, as opposed to validation, well, that's where your problems start to creep in.
Yeah, I found, I mean, we found as a supplier of a solution that if it's not part of your everyday work, it's like using any system, isn't it? If it's not part of your everyday work, you forget your password. Or by the time it comes login, I mean, it drives me crackers using our online bank. Every 30 days, the online bank forces me to change my password. And again, and it needs 18 characters, and you're into, again, like, you've got to remember what it is, you've got to write it down, but it's not necessary, you know, if you've got a better password thing. So, because I don't use it, well, I'm using it now, but in the past, right, before I was managing all the finances of the business, I hardly ever logged in. So every time I logged in, I had to reset my password. I didn't have a clue what it was. But now I'm doing it every day, financial stuff every day. You know, I can remember it. But if it's any system that I don't use on an absolutely daily basis, I will not remember the password, and I'll have to go through the password reset routine every time. I mean, but then you know, I've got a really bad memory.
Yes, as have I. I mean, yeah, it's a particularly interesting conversation. I mean, one of the things that I think people are pointing out in the chat is we probably could and should do a full session on this topic, Phil, one that we possibly researched a little bit better. But also that depends what you're after. Some of them have, so Rick's pointing out that a number of solutions have particularly good modules for DSARS, for instance, but there's kit that won't offer you that functionality.
I have to say I was disappointed with what OneTrust, the extent of what OneTrust did. Now, maybe this client has only activated certain parts of it, but, you know, there's a lot it doesn't do.
Yeah, and I mean, Michael actually has just made a fantastic point about, I don't know how to summarize this, but basically saying that it can be a nightmare to set up, and you need people in position still for a while afterwards to make sure it's administered. And that's a very good point, because if it's this specific person who set it up and it's effectively, you know, their project, it's their brainchild, if they leave the business, you might be in trouble. And we see that consistently, because, and then it gets forgotten about, and then no one knows how to use OneTrust, and all of a sudden it falls out of favor and no one's using it, and you're paying for a solution that doesn't, you know, it's not been updated in the last 2 years or something. Yeah. So at that point, obviously it's completely redundant anyway. I mean, really, again, to reiterate it, I think the key to me is, does it work for you from a practical perspective? And does it work with your, I guess, way of working? One of the things that I struggled with one of the solutions, which I won't name to try and keep impartial, but one of the solutions I was working with, I was going through the process of building ropers in there. And what I struggled with is, even though there was absolutely nothing wrong with a kit whatsoever, basically the way it was designed is you had to build your ropers from an asset-led perspective. So you had to create all of your assets. So whether that's a category of personal data or a category of data subject or whatever, you had to build all of that and then connect the dots. Now, I know some people might go, well, yeah, well, how else would you do it? Well, the thing is, I tend to think in process-led, right? I tend to think, okay, well, here's the, I don't know, the HR process and here's what's involved in it. And having to sort of reverse engineer that, if you like, was really difficult for me. Now, that's nothing to do with the kit. It's built that way and it works perfectly fine for loads of people, I'm sure. But for me specifically, I had quite a hard time with it. And
yeah, that's quite interesting. I mean, I've got to go out and do all these data audits. I haven't done one of these types of discovery things for a couple of years, I don't think. But when I have done them in the past, you know, going and having workshops for departments, I always take a two-pronged approach. So think about what systems you use and then what you use them for. And then think about what you're doing, processing, you know, processes. And then hopefully, you know, by taking that two-pronged approach, we should arrive at most of what you're doing. And I take the pragmatic view that you might not get it all first time around, but you should get the most obvious stuff and the bigger stuff. And then as you're doing audits and reviews and other bits of the compliance work, other things will probably pop out the woodwork and you can add them on. So I see what you're saying. If you're taking the information asset kind of systems-based approach, you know, some people don't think like that. Think about, you know, end-to-end flows and processes, don't they?
Yeah, so that's what I'm getting at. And the problem with that is that then if I'm creating an entry for this process, shall we say, HR recruitment maybe, and as part of that I need to include a new type of personal data that we've not collected previously. Maybe we have an entry for, I don't know, DBS checks, for instance. But the problem is if I've not already set that up, then I'm not able to link it in. Now, as I say, for some people, that'd be fine because they'd have gone through the process and already created that entry and then it'd just be linking up the dots. But it's just not really how I think. However, I will say, not really however, it's not a counterpoint, it's just a different one. Jenny's point, I think, is fantastic, which is that one real benefit to some of these pieces of kit is collaborative working, particularly on things like DPIAs, because I'm sure we've all been involved in cases where a DPIA is just in a Word document and you end up with 15 different versions and no one knows, you know, whose turn it is. You've got comments left, right and centre. Yeah.
But for DPIAs, though, I have used in the past, and actually a different customer I'm working with has suggested we do use this for their DPIAs, which is the Canils PIA tool, which is a free open source either single user or multi-user PIA tool. And it's really quite good, actually. I used it a few years ago in a project, and we said, well, we need to have PIA centralized. It's a global company, we need to have them centralized. Let's deploy this, because you can build approvals processes, you can customize the forms, you know, you can stop a DPIA progressing without stepping through an approvals process. And it is collaborative and it is multi-user if you deploy it that way. And it's free, you know, I think it's pretty good, actually. But, you know, there aren't free versions of other, you know, useful tools around.
Do you know what? I'd completely forgotten about the Canil tool, actually. Yeah, that's on me. I'd completely forgotten about it. But, yeah, you're right. It is very good.
Yeah, I've installed it on my laptop, Rick. I think it's Rick that's saying you can't install it on a laptop. But I certainly I've used it on my laptop before. I'd love to get into, and Andy Godfrey's said he uses a complex Excel workbook with macros. I tell you what, I love macros. I'd love to get under the skin of that and see what neat things you've built. I do like Excel as a product because it's effectively got its own language. You know, it's a great tool, but unless it's set up properly, it isn't.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I know one of my customers had built their DPIA tool in Excel and had built a really, really good tool with it, effectively. And it had initially when someone was reviewing it, they were sort of going, oh my God, I can't believe you'd do your DPIs in Excel. What kind of heathen would do this? But actually it was set up brilliantly, and there was a whole process for the screening checklist and completion of that, and at various points it would notify the DPO, ping an email to the DPO if necessary. Really, really good piece of kit. But as you say, you have to understand and set it up properly, which I certainly don't claim to have that knowledge.
Hmm.
You've popped a link, I see, to the CNIL tool in the chat.
I was speaking to it. Rick beat me to it, yeah. And Ben said, you know, I don't know if he mentioned this or I, whoever mentioned it first, but it's good to see, you know, that it's what I like about it. Why I wanted to raise it all is because there are some good tools around, and, you know, without good tools, it just makes the battle harder, doesn't it? And we were talking yesterday, weren't we, before this session about, I did a project maybe 4 years ago, and we used Word to create the records posting activities. It wasn't a database as such. It was individual pages in a Word workbook, and kind of it worked in that environment. Each page had its discrete record of personal activity. Of course, you couldn't get an overview of it. You couldn't say, well, you know, filter it out and show me all the records from this department, but it worked in that environment. And Excel works in other environments, but, you know, this privacy tech space, I think, is going to hopefully, you know, give us some more tools in the future.
Yeah, hopefully so. And actually, that's a really good point on Word, because, yeah, you're right, we were talking about this. And a customer that I was working with at one point also had, so basically they obviously did a number of things, back office, HR, etc. But in terms of their output, they had one service, a standardized offering, which went to all their customers, same data coming in and out, same organizations, XYZ. And therefore, it was possible to draw up basically this fixed Word document, which detailed what they were doing. And we didn't put narrative behind it necessarily, because that would be weird, but you could actually read it, you know, like an article, and you'd gain an understanding of what they did. And then there's a value in that, because we were able to share it almost as a due diligence item for organizations we're working with. So, you know, it can be done. But then obviously for the back office stuff, then we actually had an Excel sheet, because they're not a massive organization, so we could just do a little Excel sheet for everything else they were doing. But it's just interesting to see the different approaches.
I'm gonna have a look at this demystifying GDPR that's been put in the chat again. I kind of like Rick thinking, oh, if it's free, how do they make the money? But it might be there's a one free module and then the other modules are commercial. I don't know. We'll have to have a look at that. But I mean, there are more tools. Remember when we went down to PrivSec, probably 2018-17 maybe. And there weren't any. In fact, we had a tiny little stand for our DataWise, and we were the only privacy tech solution there. And, you know, they went down about 2 years later, and there was about 10. It is good, you know, because we need some decent tools, as we're saying. Anyway, I don't know if you've experienced Umel saying that OneTrust do certifications. Have you done any, Umel, any certifications for OneTrust? Are you a certified OneTrust driver?
Hi guys. So unfortunately I haven't, well, I did some back in lockdown when it was all a little bit quiet and sort of had a little bit of time to do them. But since then, I think you have to do them and then renew them on an annual basis. So yeah, I think I did two or three. I did the cookies one. I did the ones that seemed most interesting to me, but they were good. At the time, I think it was a full day session you had to do, and then you have to do an assessment at the end of the day as well. And then they give you that certification to say you're an expert in this area. I think I know some people who've done, like, there's apparently like 10 modules and you can do all of it, and then you become fellows of OneTrust certification. Right. So I haven't got that.
I've seen that, yeah. So what are you actually doing? Are you configuring it, or are you just filling in the forms? You know, what kind of level is it aimed at?
So to be honest, it's 80% of it is talking about the tool and how the tool works. And then maybe 20% of it is kind of the application of the tool with GDPR, with PECA, with, you know, the relevant jurisdictions and the areas that you're working on. But it's very much tool centric. It's kind of, it's about the tool, really.
Yeah. And did you do that because you wanted to, or did you do that through your current employment?
No.
Did you do it independently?
Yeah, I did that independently. There was a, I think there was a time when they were offering them free during lockdown. Right. So you could just, you know, you can do them yourself. And it was just something that I was interested in. But I know, yeah, some organizations tell you to do it as well. So if obviously you're using one trust, then you have to. I think it's mandatory.
Yeah, right. Okay. All right. Perfect. Well, thank you. Thank you for that.
No worries.
Ollie, you said you had a joke from Dave to share with us.
Oh, really? You're going to put me on the spot? fine. But don't listen. Don't have a go at me. It's Dave's joke. So Dave at the minute has gone on his holidays. He is on his way to Australia at the minute. And he said he would be checking out the Australian privacy scene, you know, to see what's going on there. Could be of interest. However, he is a bit worried that he might not have the right qualifications for it. There you go.
Yeah.
I mean, that's possibly one of his worst. Yeah. He was debriefing me, giving me his handover. And he said, "I've got this joke." I was like, "Oh my goodness me!"
He will rue the day he shared that with us.
Yeah. I mean, really, that was oh dear. You got me there. I didn't even pick up on that. You got me. Well done. You too, honestly.
Sorry, right, yeah. Come on, get serious again.
There's still 10 minutes to go. We can't be descending into chaos just yet. So I don't know if you, I mean, really, what's the consensus? Should we do a standalone session on this topic?
Well, I think there's a couple of people that asked for it, and I think we probably should have a look at some of the, particularly the free tools, and then we can speak from much more of a position of, you know, comparing, you know, like with like, rather than just kind of snapshotting, you know, we've had a look at this, we've had a look at that. If you've got a comparison, then that's possibly a more useful, you know, and then if it's hard to get commercials on these things, but if you can get the commercials as well, you could then say, well, this is what this kind of thing is particularly good at this. You could use it for all the things, and the commercial model looks like that. So it might take us a bit of time to pull that information together, but I think it would be useful to do, but I don't know if,
you know. Well, Umal sent some clapping hands, so I assume that's an endorsement. And yeah,
she's responding to the joke.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
No, she's not really.
Sure. But yeah, I mean, Miles is saying we've got an open slot for a discussion.
I think that's too soon, Miles.
A bit too soon. I think I'd like to research the topic a little bit more before we get stuck in properly, because it's all well and good saying I've been fiddling around with OneTrust this week, but really, you know, we need to take a proper look at it so that we've got some actual knowledge to share and some informed views to share as well, as opposed to just us nattering on about it. Yeah, exactly. But we'll get that set up if that's of interest. Any more to say on that front, or?
I don't think so. We could probably keep, but I think we'll probably just keep talking over the same points again and again. I think we've possibly exhausted it, unless anybody's got anything they want to chuck in from the floor.
Christine saying it would be really helpful to have some independent reviews of pros and cons.
We might not be able to. I mean, it would be great if we could do that. I think the best way to do that would be to engage with each company, tell them what we're doing, and you know, try and do that objectively and properly. That, I think that really would be useful, actually, and that might be something we should do. That might be the approach we should take. If we're just grabbing the free version and having a poke around with it without any training and that, we might actually misrepresent them.
Yeah, I think that's a very likely possibility. So you want to do it properly. I mean, because that's the thing, right? Like, you've been talking about the training available for OneTrust, and this is part of the thing, right? Is that I've been playing with it over the past couple of weeks, and I've never had any sort of formal OneTrust training. Like, I've gleaned experience effectively of you know, messing about with it, but it's nothing formal. Rick suggests a privacy tech roast. Could do.
Yeah, we do it like the gadget show. We'll see if we can get some freebies as well. Go on, bring them on.
Yeah, and well, Umal's saying that if we ask the companies, they might try and use it as a plug and give us demos.
I'm sure they would.
Which is a very real possibility, and we're sort of keen not to do that. And in fact, when Phil and I were talking about this off air yesterday, obviously we've mentioned that we've got our own platform data wise, but we certainly didn't want to turn this into a sales pitch because, well, you'd all turn off, presumably. But,
we don't do sales.
No, not at all. We're delivery solely, aren't we?
Yes.
Yes. So yeah, we'll get that set up, but maybe not next week because that might be a little too soon. But we will keep you all updated on that, and we'll look to bring you something. Because if we do it, I'd like to, you know, bring some real value to it. I think if we're going to do it, let's do it properly.
It'd be great to do it properly, yeah. So what have you got on next week then, Ollie? I've got well, it's not really an audit, it's a review. So the company wants one day where they've got a consultant that is going to kind of run through with them, you know, what they need to do and what they have got. So it's nowhere near an audit, but I have to say I'm really looking forward to that because I love doing that type of stuff, you know, working with people and helping them to understand why the requirement's there, what the requirement is, how to make it work in practice in their organisation. So I'm looking forward to that. I split over Tuesday morning and Thursday morning, and then in the middle of that Wednesday, one of my clients, I've got to do their DPO visit, which is just quarterly. So I go once a quarter and monitor, you know, I've got a schedule of what we're looking at, what I want to see. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty much the middle of my week is tied up with all that kind of stuff, which I'm looking forward to because I like getting my hands dirty on the operational stuff. What have you got on?
I am lost in the sauce with DPIAs at the minute. I am absolutely snowed in with them. I can't move for DPIAs. No, I mean, yeah, I'm working on a couple of bits and pieces. And actually, even though that acronym strikes fear into the hearts of people up and down the country, I very much like DPIAs, as most of you will know. I like getting under the hood. I like, you know, having a dig around, seeing what I can find out. I enjoy taking those things apart and sort of risk assessing them. I find it very interesting. So, yeah, I'm working on DPIAs. And then one in particular, which I'm trying to think how much I can say about it, but very interesting, all to do with cookies and analytics, which obviously is a very hot topic considering what is happening with Google Analytics at the minute. But I feel like I can't say too much about it, otherwise I'll get in trouble. But very, very interesting topic, looking at how you can make the use of cookies and used for analytics purposes more privacy conscious. To answer your question, Christine, we've looked at WhatsApp previously, but not for a long time. High risk is sorry, I've just read Rick's question accidentally halfway through that sentence. So WhatsApp's a bit of a funny one because we've had customers previously ask us whether they can implement it within the business. In our view, well, up until recently, I say we've not looked at it, but our view was that it's quite difficult to manage as an asset.
I think it was really what you're using it for. I mean, like most of these things.
There's also that.
Yeah, yeah. We keep coming across. We did a really in-depth review of Teams last year, didn't we, for a customer? But we haven't done a really in-depth review of WhatsApp. But I'd still say it depends what you use it for. And again, one of my clients just picked up. They use WhatsApp as a way of communicating with all the various people in their various teams, in their various outlets. It's a retail company. Mm. And they've got, like, you know, people from, like, they've got the cleaning staff that are employed by a subcontractor and the catering staff and the ground staff, and they're all on a WhatsApp group. It's the only way they can keep in touch with each other. But, of course, they're all using personal phones because the staff, you know, in those different service companies don't have business phones provided to them. Mm-hmm. And so they're going to ask us to have a look at that, the use of WhatsApp at some point, and which Magdalene's going to be doing rather than me, you know, to advise them, you know, if we think it's risky. And interesting, this question about, do you have a process to identify risk?
Oh, Phil, I wanted to pick that one up. Go on.
No, I'm going to leave you to it.
I'm muting. Oh, all right. Well, just, only because I had oh, he's gone.
It's all yours. No, I'm just avoiding stepping on your limelight.
No. Go on. I just had an anecdote from this week about identifying high risk, actually, which I thought was interesting and worth sharing. But please do finish your point.
No, I was going to hand over to you. I'm going to say I'm sure you've got some experience of that.
Well, I have. There we go. Thank you for that segue. I went through something this week, actually, on the high risk thing that's interesting. So One of my customers at a housing association, regular listeners will know, we work a lot with housing providers. They were using for their DPI as a form that actually we designed quite a long time ago, and I probably need to replace it. But that form, just a standard form include a screening checklist to determine whether you needed to complete a full DPIA because your processing was likely to be high risk. And it used a set of criteria which were a combination of, I think, the ICO's criteria and the ones from the European Data Protection Board guidelines on this subject. And I got one in recently and I said, well, one of the conditions has been triggered, but otherwise it all seems pretty low risk. Do we need to do a full assessment? And I said, no, I don't think so. That does seem low risk from what you've told me. I'm pretty happy to say that we don't need a full assessment. And it went back. And actually, I then got some, not flack per se, but I got some feedback from the IT department saying, you shouldn't be making exceptions for them. You know, it said one of the conditions was met. And the technical wording of the form is that if any of these conditions are met, you have to do a full DPI. Don't be making exceptions. And I mean, they're right. They're right, because then people get the wrong message. But obviously the way that we've gone back and tweaked that is to say that, you know, please fill this out. And depending on some of these conditions being met, then you need to speak to the data protection team and they'll tell you if you need to do a full assessment. Because really, as we all know here, it's never that clear cut in terms of determining what may or may not be high risk. And sometimes you need the opportunity to have a bit of leeway and have a bit of wiggle room and say, well, on this occasion, all things considered, I don't think it's high risk. But it was just interesting that, you know, to me, it was a done thing. You know, I was asked, you know, whether I thought there was high risk, it needed a full DPI, and I sort of nonchalantly, you know, without giving it a thought, went, yeah, no, it doesn't. But it's a very good point about, you know, process and the rest of the organisation.
Interesting, because this as you know, we're doing, this company I'm doing the OneTrust work for is actually a marketing agency, and they've defined, and you might, because you're doing a piece of work for a sister company, you might find the same thing, but they've defined high risk as being anything, I mean, they've defined it, but two aspects of it are anything that involves over 2,500 data subjects, or anything that involves over 100,000 records, and they've hard coded that into their OneTrust platform. So as I'm compiling the ROPAs, if anything, you know, falls into any of those conditions, then it automatically triggers a PIA initial questionnaire thing, and then, you know, when you fill that in, you might trigger actually a full PIA. So That's you know, quite interesting, but we've got guidance on it. But I think the message to me is that, you know, what's high risk in one place might not be high risk in another context. You know, so it's a fact, bunch of factors, isn't it?
It is, which is a suitably loose answer for us. So that sits me down to the ground. But you're right. I mean, you know, it's a case by case basis. Risk is a moving target, and it's going to depend on the context of your organisation. Because, as you quite rightly say there, going off purely the number of records or the number of data subjects, well, that's just going to vary in terms of the size of the business, right? Because
it's a function of resource as well. You know, there may be identifying, well, exactly, yeah, you know, we haven't got resources. You know, anything that goes over a certain volume is going to really stretch our resources. Therefore, the likelihood of having a mistake, but making this stuff up, because I don't know that this is the case, but they've obviously thought about it and decided that they're going to define, you know, high risk processing as anything that is this, or this, including the volume of records involved. I mean, Rick's just triggered a thought. I mean, Rick's saying anything that involves marketing is high risk. And that's what the point I was trying to make, or meant to make, about the French presidential candidates' websites, that there's probably been built, as we found when we went with our new website a few months ago, it got built, you know, by a professional web building company, and they put all sorts of stuff in we didn't ask them to. We had to ask them to take it off. I mean, he asked Miles, you know, he spent a few weeks now unraveling things, like, you know, they put live chat on. We didn't ask for live chat. What have they got? What are they using live chat? You know, we haven't done our due diligence on that. So, you know, there's a good chance that, you know, poor old Emmanuel Macron's pushing on with his presidential campaign, and he said, well, you've got to get my website up and running, and somebody's built it and not told him what they're doing. You know, not taking his brief and used artistic license to, you know, introduce all sorts of great time-saving tech tools and, well, you know, make them compliant. The website is a classic, isn't it, though?
It's one of the number one things we hear when we start looking at cookies for customers is, oh, well, why didn't the web developers tell us? Why didn't the people we engaged to build the website, rather, why didn't they tell us that you had to be getting consent for these types of cookies, etc.? And we hear it systematically, or instances where, you know, okay, well, what does that cookie do? No idea. No idea what it does. Don't know.
Mm.
Yeah, we didn't put it there. It's been there the whole time, but it's not ours. And, you know, to an extent, that's kind of what you're saying is that a lot of the time, you know, organisations just don't have that level of, no, of oversight, I suppose.
What we're saying is that marketing run off down a tangent.
Well, there's also bamboozled
by web developers.
I certainly
no offence, Miles, no offence.
Yeah, misrepresent our dear colleagues in marketing, but Rick's accusations, I don't think, are wholly unfounded when it comes to high risk. Rick also saying, let's not forget cybersecurity. DLP tools can have a huge impact.
Mm.
I don't know what you mean that in relation to, though, Rick. Have I missed a trick there?
I should take myself off mute. Yeah. I just meant that the tracking tools that you could have that you're using to secure your workforce, you know, some of the stuff that we're doing almost click by click monitoring of staff's, you know, internet use.
Oh, sorry, devices. I see what you mean. Yeah.
So it's all that stuff that may be used for digital forensics or, you know, data loss prevention could be, you know, have a huge impact really on the privacy.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And then the risk there, obviously, is that the thinking behind it is, well, it's, you know, for security purposes, it's one of our tools, so it must be all right.
And this is where it clearly goes to, you know, it's a clear legitimate interest of the organisation to keep everything as secure as possible. But then you're saying, okay, but you're balancing that against the loss of the rights and freedoms of individuals. So it's always a challenging one.
Yeah, it is. It absolutely is. And I, funnily enough, Umar's here. Umar and I went through the process with a piece of kit that a customer was wants to use for real-time log monitoring, I think. And that came into it, and we did quite an extensive piece of work doing due diligence on them. But yeah, you're absolutely spot on, Rick. I tell you what, I've only really just noticed that we're already over by 5 minutes. The problem is, people listening are excusing themselves, and that's normally my prompt to start wrapping up. So somehow it's not my fault, but we do need
to
wrap up.
We didn't overrun, Ollie, when you were on holiday.
I've heard about the half-hour session. Dear me. Is Kathy not here to keep us in check? No, Kath's not here today, I'm afraid, Umal. We do need her. Keep us all in check. Anyway, Phil, let's bring it to a close then. Final thoughts for this week? Anything you want to share with the group before we adjourn?
Don't, I can't think of anything, except I'm looking forward to next week. So looking forward to getting on with me or reviews and DPO work.
Well, that's very positive, isn't it? And it's nice to hear. Likewise, I'm looking forward to some of the bits and pieces I've got coming up next week. And speaking of things coming up next week, we will be back with another episode of the podcast. What that looks like at this moment in time, I'm not entirely sure. We possibly need to do some work to fill that slot. But, you know, worst case scenario, it'll be an episode of GDPR Radio. So do come along for that. If you are listening in and you're not here with us live, you can sign up to join the sessions live through the events page on the DPP website. Events page, which also lists all of the upcoming sessions we'll be hosting, and that gets updated by Miles whenever there's anything to update. So I encourage you to go and check that out. I think that's going to be it for us. So thank you everyone for your time. Hope you all have a lovely afternoon and a lovely weekend, and we'll catch up with you very soon.
Yes, thank you everyone, and thank you, Ollie. Have
lovely
a great
stuff.
Weekend.
Yep. Yep. Likewise. Take care, all.
Bye bye.